Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 81, titled Faith, Doubt, Skepticism, Intuition.
In all of this, one thing I just want to say in relation to the issue of faith and doubt and skepticism, it's not really, you know, the Buddhists didn't have an expression Buddhism. They didn't use that expression. If to make, to find out, you know, enlightenmentism, you might say, if ism means sort of a system organized with a certain, in orientation toward a certain reality, you would call it enlightenmentism, you know. But Buddhism to us, it connotes, oh yeah, Christianity, Buddhism, Islam, it's like a category. So the reason that the depth of gnosis, as you said, is like Buddhism is because it is a scientific and a technology developed on a way of understanding the way the mind works, conscious and unconscious, interconnected. And that's all that Buddhist science is. And we say Buddhist only because it came down in the tradition that connects to Buddha. But for example, the thing like someone has been introduced the possibility of there being sort of some sort of angelic enlightened bodhisattvas out all around, maybe available to help in some way. Okay? But it seems very doubtful. So then there's two sides to how one would meditate about that and work with that and look at one's comfort and discomfort, which would never be just saying, okay, somebody said that, so now I have to think they're Taurus. I have to think. I mean, in one way, that might not be too bad. You're like thinking of something positive and you're saying, I should think about something positive. That's okay. But the more important is, why am I feeling discomfort? Why does it seem so surprising to me that that could happen? What are the cultural structures, expectations, sense of consensual level of reality, especially the powerful materialism that we're all indoctrinated in classrooms as we grow up in school, which has some good side too, because we're not scared of hell and we're not, the preacher is not running out trying to catch us around in the bushes or something. I mean, it's like, that's good that they rebelled against those lunatics in Europe who were burning witches and had Inquisition dungeons. That's great. I'm all for the scientists going and dealing with them. But then they get trapped in another direction. So I don't think I'm just anti-science. I'm very pro-science. But the thing is, whenever they shift into being dogmatic without evidence, then they're no longer science. Then they have an inquisition. They are having dogmas. So the way you work with it is your inner Tara, your inner paramita, transcendent wisdom, works on looking at, well, there's this possibility that I heard, that I sort of had a fantasy about or I imagined, somebody talked about it, written in a book, but seems very unlikely to me. Oh, but why does it seem so unlikely to me? What do I think is real? Why do I think it's real? And what I think is real, etc. So those things always go together. For example, in the meditation on coming to an awareness, which to me, if there's any one takeaway, woman's group, men's group, any group in America, it is to discover that you are a much bigger being than just yourself in this life. You have this vast, infinite former experience, personally, not just your genes, and you have this future long travel route to book your reservations in. Where are you going to go? That shifts the way we deal with the moment vastly. You know, there's a big thing about being in the moment. I told Eckhart Tolle, I said, who was a friend of mine, I said, if you push that moment so much without questioning people's materialism, if they didn't exist before they were born, they won't exist again after death, and therefore their deeper reality is non-existence. The moment becomes an escapist kind of, I just don't have to care, be responsible. They get a little relief from that. Yeah, they feel like, yeah, I'm here in the moment, but it doesn't link up to a sort of larger spiritual motivation to expand their awareness. So, but when you do that meditation about possibility of former and future life, the most important part of it is, well, why does it seem so strange to me? Why does it feel so unfamiliar to me? Why does it seem so uncomfortable to me? why is it I feel so natural just to not exist when dying? Why do I feel it's so natural not to feel I'm just my body? You know? And you have a lot of people going, I've got to be more body. Oh, all those religions, they want the mind to be separate from the body. They're despising the body. You have feminist theologians getting all into that. You know? And that's a simplistic. Right? So it's always, you know, your mind, you want to cultivate the tolerance of cognitive dissonance, the tolerance of ambiguity in your mind from the very beginning, and be able to embrace different possibilities, sort of from different perspectives, right? Rather than just always be like on one track, okay? I think that's important, right? So discomfort with this idea is important. And we have to look at why and what are its causes and reasons, right? That's really cool, really different.
The tolerance of ambiguity and tolerance of
cognitive dissonance.
What's that?
You have to be able to tolerate cognitive dissonance.
Because enlightenment is the ultimate embrace of cognitive dissonance. In a certain way, inconceivably. So, as I described, probably in too much verbiage. Already.
No.
Yes, Alexandra.
How does intuition with all this?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that. If I can say something, that's one of my favorite things. Actually, intuition is a really important thing. But it's complicated a little bit. Now, if you ever read Immanuel Kant, I presume you might have. And, you know, he used the word intuition, or what's the German for that? I forgot. Not Sinnlichkeit. I can't remember right now. But by what his translators, anyway, translated as intuition in English, to mean a direct, unmediated experience of something. Not mediated through a concept. Something known directly. Like they have sense intuition and he had intellectual intuition. Which is therefore not a path of reasoning. The sense intuition is not, but he had the idea that your sense intuition of the table doesn't use the label table. It directly sees the table without categorizing it with a mediating concept. And therefore, since it couldn't reach the thing in itself, which he presumed was in the table, this is where Kant is very different from Buddhism. Therefore, it's sort of, it's unintelligible almost in a conceptual way to the person, intuition is. And yet he used it as a direct, as opposed to inference, which is conceptual. So the Buddhists also have a term, which they unfortunately translate, most of the modern people do, as perception, which is a very brilliant thing, where your sense perceptions, as they use that term, which I would say Kantian-wise, your sense intuitions are, it's like you see, the way they would say it is, you see blue, and in a way you don't recognize it as blue. You cognize blue, but you don't recognize it as blue. You just go into blueness. And when you see quote blue, unquote, then you're having a mediated perception of blue, because your conceptual apparatus functions, and it restricts that color experience from not being yellow, not being green, not being white, not being red, and makes it, and then you label it and you recognize it, recognize it as blue. You follow me? And actually, your direct experience of things where you can't fit them into your concepts, where you directly see them, are kind of your Buddha awareness, actually. But in a way, they're inaccessible to you because you feel you're not having it until you can label it. Because you have to fit, in an effort to have control, we have to fit our experiences into our conceptual presupposition. Do you follow me? So we have to fit our concepts. Whereas when we directly experience something, it's a fresh thing, and it doesn't. It's like at first you're not quite sure what it is, and then you close around it with your concept. If you follow me. So it's a difficult job to disentangle. That those concepts from the pure, fresh sense perception, as they translate, but I prefer to say sense intuition. So now, there's also the idea of feminine intuition, which means a kind of knowing which is precisely unmediated and inexplicable by concept. And I feel it's very valuable in that sense that if people understand intuition as a direct, unmediated, transconceptual cognition, sense, or even the sixth sense, which is intellect, then enlightened awareness and that feminine intuition can be interconnected. The slight danger about it is that a racist has an intuition that that person that they're racist about, sort of without thinking twice, is like lesser or inferior or something wrong with it. A sexist also has that, you know. So there can be hidden concepts that create distorted, seemingly direct, intuitive things. So intuition can become distorted.
It's not a pure...
What?
It's not a pure element.
Not what?
It's not a pure... What was
the... Yeah, not if it's pure, yeah. But the point is, there has to be a kind of process of cleansing intuition from infection by distorting concepts, let's say. However, people go on wisdom about this super knowing that I've mentioned before. Whereas I like to connect it with the language of intuition, which has the both high Kantian epistemological sense of direct and unmediated, and also the feminine intuition idea, which is a popular one, but really valuable, I think. And I'm working on that. Now, let me give you my example that I work with. When you have learned that left and right are reversed in your mirror, so when you put on your face, or a man when they shave, when they put the razor on what looks like the left side of their cheek and are actually shaving the right side, they don't think twice about that because in a way they learned that already and it's now accurate. It was corrected from the distortion and it's accurate. And yet the intuition doesn't interfere with looking in detail at that part of the face or if you're doing your eyeliner or whatever stuff you do. You know, you just do it without thinking twice. So you have simultaneously a conceptual functioning that's looking at what's in the mirror and dealing with the detail, you know, a little over here, a little more there. You know, you're dealing with specifics in the relation there. And there's a deeper intuition that this is an illusion in a mirror. So the knowledge of the fact that it's a mirror reflection is directly known simultaneously without having to be refreshed. While the other one is functioning, doesn't cripple the other one, but in a way it allows the other one to make an automatic correction of the left-right reversal. And this to me is really valuable because when you have realized emptiness in the first level where things have disappeared under analysis, self and world, and then the world is back and it seems to be all separate from that space that was empty, but then after a while you can begin to meld them together, then that emptiness, which then you can play around, becomes a membrane that is known intuitively without a second thought while you're engaged in dealing with the relationalities, if you follow. And that's the tolerance of cognitive dissonance functioning. And the embrace of cognitive dissonance functions like that. But to make it so vast and cosmic the way they do is, of course, becomes inconceivable. These are only analogies that open one to such inconceivability. Okay? So anyway, bottom line, we like intuition, but it should be checked. It should be also checked with critical analysis to make sure. And this is the thing about Buddhist psychology, Buddhist as a science. Buddhists are not content, like Freud, to have a big unconscious and have their consciousness be tip of iceberg. That is the ordinary person. But the project for the Buddhist, for the person, it doesn't have to be Buddhist, for the person seeking higher consciousness, enlightenment, is to become more and more conscious of the unconscious, deeper and deeper. And actually, when you get to a certain point where it's safe, that's when Tantra is getting down to Eros and Thanatos, you know, Freud's favorite, Eros and Thanatos, the deepest drives in the unconscious, getting down to deal with them and confront them and deal with them. So that the ideal is to be fully conscious of everything. No autonomic nervous system. A Buddha is defined as a being that doesn't have to inhale by any kind of automatic reflex. If it would do better for the other beings around them not to breathe, they could just do it out of it. And they wouldn't inhale, which is inconceivable. But apparently that's what they claim we are capable of. It. Sooner or later, some lifetime or another. And they have some reasoning to do that. Anyway, okay, did you want to say something else?
Yeah. Based on what you said, just to make it clear for myself, so intuition is not really intuition. Is it based on past subconscious experiences? Did I get you right?
Well, no. I
it's
think
not
pure,
like fresh.
Pure intuition is... If you use intuition as I would like for what's called pratyaksha in Sanskrit, in Buddhist epistemology, if you use intuition for that, which I think it should be, then intuition is like when you see something, there's a split second where you are where at the thing you see. There's no gap between you and the thing you see. The minute you can recognize it, which is you file it and you draw from your bank of concepts and you place a concept over it and exclude what does not fit your concept in your perception, then you're no longer over there. You're back here and you've controlled that by recognizing. So the intuition, what I would like to call intuition, is that split second, and for an enlightened being it can be just living that, actually, is being a field which is embracing everything you see and hear and feel and think. You identify with it all. You're one with it all. It's all you. And you don't have to recognize it and file it away in some personal control, you know, like identity, you know, NSA spy file. Oh, that's a side. No, that's a table. Oh, that's the rail. Oh, that's our center. You don't have to do that. You just meet it. And you, in a way, because it's not you. It's not you. But, and to, it doesn't, you don't control it with a conceptual apparatus.